Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. Eileen Kane, an associate professor of history at Connecticut College who specializes in modern Russia and Eurasia, understanding Russia within the broader histories of Europe, Asia, and the rest of the world, and taking a comparative and global approach to the study of history in general. Professor Kane's interests topically include empires, migrations, religion, and historical connections between the Russian and Ottoman empires. Her research has taken her to archives and manuscript collections in St. Petersburg, Moscow, Odessa, Tbilisi, and Istanbul. She has been supported by numerous national fellowships and grants, including a National Endowment for the Humanities Fellowship and a publication grant from the American Association of University Women. Professor Kane recently published a very interesting book with Cornell University Press entitled Russian Hajj, Empire and the Pilgrimage to Mecca. You can find a link to that book and other stuff about our guest over at our website, www.researchonreligion.org. So please stop by and also tell a friend. And also find us on Twitter and tweet, I say. Eileen, glad to have you on Research on Religion.
Thank you for having me.
I have to note that we are recording this on January 22nd, and that is right around the time of the great snowpocalypse of 2016. And I just want to make sure that you have plenty of milk, bread, and vodka stocked up for that disaster.
Me? Yes, I'm all set.
Okay, you're all set. So we won't have to worry if the snow or if the roof caves in from snow, just let us know and we'll reschedule for some other time. But
thank
I
you.
Think you're going to be okay. So let's talk about your book. Of all the topics that one could study in modern Russian history, from wars with Napoleon to peasant land reform and from Peter the Great to Boris Yeltsin or Vladimir Putin, you chose to study how Russian czars and the Soviet Communist Party managed a pilgrimage of Muslims to Mecca. Now most folks, including many historians, I would bet, wouldn't even think of this as something that ever existed, let alone something to research. So my first question here, obviously, is how did you come up with this topic?
So, yes, what does Islam have to do with Russia? In the United States, we think of Islam often in terms of the Arab world, so the Middle East and North Africa, and Arabs. And this isn't quite right. About two-thirds of the world's Muslims live in what we consider today India, Pakistan, basically from India to China, what's often called the Asia-Pacific region. And Russia has been ruling Muslims since the 15th century. But you're right. Until very recently, we historians of Russia didn't write about this history. The story of Russian history, certainly the one I got in college, was about mainly the Slavic-speaking regions of the empire and the Russians, largely focused on Moscow and St. Petersburg, so the imperial capitals. And, it makes sense that I'm writing on this actually because of the generation that I come from. You know, I was in college when the Soviet Union broke up, and one of the things that happened as a result of this in the field of history is that there was much more attention to the diversity of Russia, not just today. Russia still today is very diverse. It has a Muslim population of between 10% and 15%. But the empire was and the Soviet Union, I should say, was basically the old Russian empire put back together with a couple pieces missing. So the breakup of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s kind of reminded historians that the Russian empire was this incredibly diverse place, as empires always are. It broke up into 15 nation states in, 91 to 92, and six of these had Muslim majorities. So this was very much on people's mind in the 1990s when I graduated from college and then went and spent 2 years on a Fulbright in Turkey and then started graduate school. So as I said, the history of Russia was for a long time written as the history of Slavs and Christians. And we can think of this is sort of like writing the history of the United States as though it were just the history of white people. So a lot got left out. A lot was missing, and you know, not just Muslims. There are many other groups that people started to write about in the 90s. So my work was very much a part of this. But I would say that I went into the archives at first to write about Orthodox pilgrimage, so Christian pilgrimage from Russia to Jerusalem. You know, as you mentioned early on, I'm interested in these two empires, the Russian and the Ottoman Empire, and their connections to one another, and so. It was only when I got into the archives that I started to find all this stuff on the Hajj. And there was a lot that had been written about Orthodox pilgrimage, but nothing on this. So this just seemed really cool and interesting and exciting, and there was so much stuff the more I started digging. And in fact, the Hajj was a bigger, in terms of just the number of people going, it was Russia's biggest pilgrimage in the 19th and early 20th century, but there had been nothing written about it so far.
Yeah, that's a really cool discovery, and graduate students and undergraduate students should pay attention, because when they oftentimes come to my office and say, well, you know, I want to write a thesis and I want to study this, but nobody's written anything on it. What do I do? And I said, that's great. You get to write it. You get to lay claim to all of this. So that is a really cool something that you discovered there, and we are glad that you've written this up. In fact, when the book came across my desk, I looked at this, I go, Russian Hajj? But there's no such thing. And as I dug into the book, I said, this is a really cool thing. I'm glad somebody wrote about it. So let's start into the subject by getting a bit of the lay of the land. And since you're a historian, you always think about dates, I would assume, and the time frame that you are examining is going to be important here. So let's go ahead and define what the time frame that you're looking at here, how you historically bookend your project, which to me it appears to be roughly the mid-19th century to about the 1930s. So why did you choose those dates, and what's special about that time?
So the dates, the first chapter starts in the 1840s in the Caucasus, when they start to get a sense of, they set up an administration in the Caucasus, a place that they've recently colonized, the Russians, and they start to see people going on the Hajj, and they also at this time are opening new consulates in Ottoman Syria, because this is a time of imperial competition over what was known at the time as Ottoman Palestine. And this is going to connect to the eruption of the Crimean War in the mid-19th century. So I start before the Crimean War, as they're kind of moving into Syria, moving into the Caucasus at the same time. And I would say that the dates came organically out of what I was finding in the material. So the 1840s, it's not that people suddenly start going on the Hajj from Russia in the 1840s, but this is when the authorities start getting a sense, start collecting data on this, and trying to figure out the patterns of this movement, because they have strategic interest in this. So it starts in the 1840s, and it goes up about to 1930. So the Soviets get involved briefly, and then the Global Depression happens, and then as of 1930, they sort of stop trying to involve themselves. I can talk more about that later when we talk about the Soviet period. But I would say that there are two bigger processes going on that kind of structured the book. And one is imperialism. So as I mentioned, Russia is expanding over the second half of the 19th century. It's been steadily expanding for centuries, but it's in the second half of the 19th century that they finally claim to have pacified and fully conquered the Caucasus, which is still today part of Russia. And their conquest of the Caucasus happened largely at Ottoman and Persian expense. So the North Caucasus is Muslim majority. There are also Muslims living in the South Caucasus, as well as Christians, Armenians, and Georgians. And then in the late 19th century, Russia conquers Central Asia, places that we know today as Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, and Tajikistan. So, and this is also a Muslim majority region. So Russia is getting bigger, and it's also getting much more Muslim. Many, many more millions of Muslim subjects are absorbed into the Russian Empire at this time. And the second thing, so imperialism is one thing. The second thing is modernization, which is this big sort of abstract term. By this I mean they build railroads and steamships. They're trying to modernize. They've just lost the Crimean War. It was a disastrous, embarrassing defeat, and they start to reevaluate, and they say, we need to modernize. And one of the things they do to modernize is build railroads across the empire very quickly. And the state also sponsors steamship lines out of Black Sea ports and other ports. So this, the creation of a transportation infrastructure has the unintended effect of making it easier for Muslims to go on the Hajj, among other things. So these two things, imperialism and modernization, really sort of structure the story that I tell, because it's in this period that the Hajj in Russia, as in other parts of the world, becomes a mass phenomenon and one that the state is suddenly very interested in.
We'll talk about the Hajj here in a second, but in terms of the imperial expansion, obviously railroads probably enhanced the ability of the Russians to do that, because you can move bullets, band-aids, and beans down there to your troops and take over the territory militarily. But how did the takeover go? Was it pretty peaceful? Was there fighting going on? I know the Ottoman Empire at this time is on the decline and being called the sixth man of Europe in some respects. So how did that expansion occur?
So, of course, there's resistance. There's a very long anti-colonial resistance movement against the Russia's colonization of the Caucasus. There's resistance also in Central Asia, but there's not a long, drawn-out war in the same way that there is in the Caucasus. In part, I mean, there are many reasons for this, but one of the things is that they don't try all the same things in Central Asia that they've tried in the Caucasus. And one of the things they forbid, the state that is attempts to convert Central Asians to Russian Orthodox Christianity, which is the state religion. The Orthodox Church is the privileged church in the Russian Empire. And so they say, we're not going to do what we tried in the Caucasus, which caused a backlash. Don't even try to convert people. So there, we often put the Caucasus and Central Asia together, but there are many differences in the two cases in terms of Russia's colonization.
Actually, tell me about that first effort to convert Muslims in the Caucasus. And first of all, define Caucasus. You mentioned today's geography. It would be Georgia. It would be, would the Ukraine, parts of the Ukraine be part of that? What are the Caucasus?
So the Caucasus is a mountainous region between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. And typically it's divided, the North Caucasus and the South Caucasus. There's the mountain range runs through the middle. So the North Caucasus is part of Russia today. It includes places that we have heard of because of events in the news. Even general readers may have heard of places like Chechnya and Dagestan and other regions, but these are all regions within what is today the Russian Federation. The South Caucasus is made up of three what had been regions of the Russian Empire and then became republics of the Soviet Union and today are independent nation states, and those are Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan.
Okay. And so the Russians show up there in the middle part of the 19th century, and they find a lot of Muslims, and their first reaction is, hey, that's cute, but wouldn't you like to be Russian Orthodox? Did they wave a big wand, say, okay, y'all or Russian Orthodox now, or was there some kind of prolonged effort to missionize these folks at the grassroots? What was the thinking about conversion?
So they've been involved. They don't just show up in the 19th century, actually. They've been involved for centuries in the Caucasus, and it's only in the 19th century that they attempt to and claim to pacify the region. There's still resistance, of course, but they, as of 1864, they say we've officially pacified the region, and it's part of the Russian Empire, which it remains until the end, and then it gets reincorporated eventually into what becomes the Soviet Union. So there were attempts to convert Muslims, and not just Muslims, but people of other faiths, to Russian Orthodoxy, and then the decision was made that this was not a good idea because it was causing resistance, and like any empire, you know, if you want to sort of keep an empire together, you have to, it never really works to have a blanket approach or a decree from the center, even if you could ensure that it would be carried out in the provinces, that there was kind of trial and error, and a sense that you have to kind of allow for people to continue their ways of life if you want to hold on to regions. This is sort of very generally what empires do. They don't always, if the ones that last, you have the Mongols in mind, they were very good at this. We have a better sense of this now with new wonderful studies of the Mongol Empire, that you don't go in and try to convert people. That historically doesn't work for empires. The better approach, better in the sense of actually holding on to these territories and making them useful to the empire, is to sort of allow people to continue their way of life, which includes religion.
Yeah, that's one of those lessons that throughout history, it seems people keep forgetting. So the next time I try building my empire, I'm going to take your advice. I'm going to pick up your book and then realize, okay, just let these folks live as they would be, and don't try to convert them to anything else. So it's also a practical handbook for empire builders, I guess.
Well, I think, and also anyone who has any sense of or experience with religion would know that it's, this idea that you just go in and convert everyone, it can't possibly be that simple. I mean, people, of course, there are always going to be people, and there were such cases in the Russian Empire and other cases where people converted, because to convert meant you shed legal disabilities, you gained privileges. So self-interest is certainly going to fuel conversion, as it does, still does in some cases, and certainly did in this case. But you can't just go in and tell people that they're of a different faith, and that's not how religion works. You don't tell people what to believe or tell them which faith to be a part of. It's religion is a complicated thing that you can't just dictate to people.
Yeah, deeply embedded in people's lives, and that's another lesson we need to keep in mind as well. So let's talk about these folks who have this different religion than the Russians down there in the Caucasus region. They're Muslims, and the Russians show up, and they find out that there's this thing called the Hajj. And for those of us who might not really know what that is, explain to us what the Hajj is, and more specifically, what the Hajj was for Russians at, or I should say the Caucasus region at this time, the late 19th century, early 20th century.
So the Hajj is, this is a word we use in English. You can find it in the dictionary. It's an Arabic word that refers to the Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca. It is one of the five pillars of Islam. The pillars of Islam are belief, worship, fasting, almsgiving, and the pilgrimage. Every Muslim who is able to is required to make the pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in her lifetime. So that doesn't mean that every single Muslim does that. It's very expensive, even today, perhaps especially today. And so it's a rule. You could think of it, these pillars as rules that structure the practice of Islam for Muslims. So it happens once a year. It's different from other pilgrimages in this and other respects. So it's not something, that you can do at any time. It needs to happen at a particular time during the last month of the Islamic lunar calendar. So and this is important to remember too, because it means that you get huge crowds once a year, and then so it's all happening at the same time, which is part of why the crowds are so huge. And if you read the newspaper, usually if you have any sense of the Hajj, it's probably because, and you don't study Islam, it's probably because it gets covered once a year in the newspaper. And this past year, especially when bad things happen, like this past year, there was a terrible stampede that I think thousands of people died in. So managing these crowds is a huge challenge for the Saudi government today. I think something like as many as 3 million people here make it today. So it happens once a year at a set time. It's obligatory, as I mentioned. And in Russia, to get back to this, modernization, railroads and steamships, one of the effects of building a modern transport network is that you have already patterns of people moving, migration patterns, one of which is the Hajj. So this gets accelerated because of modern transport. And of course, not just in Russia, but elsewhere. And this is, of course, part of the bigger story of how people start moving around. We call this the mobility revolution that happens in the 19th century, that suddenly people ordinary people, all kinds of people, not just wealthy and connected people, have the ability to move long distance. So the Hajj is part of this story. So by 1900, you have tens of thousands of Muslims making the Hajj through Russian lands and from Russia. And I should add that they're not just Russian subjects. They're also people coming in primarily from Persia and, you know, just across the southern borders, Persia, Afghanistan, parts of China. And they're coming into Russia because of these railroads. They're sort of taking a more circuitous route to Mecca, but they're taking railroads and steamships because it ends up being faster. So, and, you know, in the late 19th, early 20th century, it's not just wealthy people. We have this sense that, and I think this is right, that historically the kinds of Muslims who made the pilgrimage, first of all, the numbers were pretty small, especially for people coming from far away, like South Asia or Siberia, or even Central Asia, that you needed a lot of money and a lot of time to do this. So it primarily was not ordinary people. So by the early 20th century, you have a Hajj that is mass. It is dominated by, in fact, poor people, and it's largely a colonial phenomenon. So one of the effects of colonialism around the world is that the Hajj, colonialism, as European powers went into Asia and Africa and colonized places, they typically brought railroads and steamships with them. And as you noted early on in this interview, it was about, you know, they didn't do this to sort of offer people transport around the world. This was part of extracting resources from places and bringing them to the metropole. But Muslims start using these networks, these transportation networks, to get to Mecca. So the Hajj, in fact, you know, to go back to the five pillars of Islam, it is one of the five pillars, but Islam becomes much more Mecca-centric in the late 19th century because of colonialism, because colonialism inadvertently makes it possible for mass travel to Mecca and for many, many more Muslims in the world to make the Hajj.
Yeah, one of the very unintended consequences that I don't think many folks realize would happen at the time, and it has huge historical implications to it. Talk about getting there. You mentioned they take railroads as the Black Sea, and some people probably went north before they went south again. Give us a sense of how they wound out about there. Did they take steamships through the Black Sea and then get off there somewhere in Istanbul? And how did they route this thing? Did they go through Iran or Persia at the time? What are they doing?
Yeah, so and here it might be useful to open a map, just to have a map handy. As I mentioned, these places, if you're listening to this, you know, very simply, there were three main routes. Now, and this was a big part of what I was doing in the book as I was telling the story, was also laying out the routes that Muslims took from Russia through Russian lands to get to Mecca, because this has interesting implications that I can talk more about. But there were three main routes. So one was by railroad and steamship through the Black Sea, primarily through the port of Odessa. The other was an old land route through the Caucasus that went down to Damascus, and then from Damascus by caravan. The Ottomans sponsored an imperial Hajj caravan that went to Mecca. And then the third route was from Central Asia down through Afghanistan to what we call today India, to Bombay, and then they would take a ship across the Indian Ocean. So those are the three main routes. These are the routes that, you know, I read a number of Hajj memoirs where Muslims talk about taking these routes, and then also the state reports that Russian officials are putting together. They agree that these are the three main routes, and they get very interested in trying to streamline the traffic along the railroad through Russia and steamship from the Black Sea. They say, okay, we have all this traffic. The best thing we can do, for a number of reasons, is try to encourage Muslims to just take this one route. So they try to streamline it along the Black Sea route with some success, I would say.
Yeah, that gets to the essence of your book, too, because you talk about how the Russians want to manage or control this. And I can imagine at the time you got some Russian officials down there going, oh, first of all, here there's a lot of Muslims. We tried converting them to Orthodoxy, but that's not working. So we'll just let them be Muslims. That seems to work out fine. But now they're every, you know, year or once a year, they seem to be walking southward. What is going on with that? How did they initially figure out what was going on or deal with this mass movement of people, especially once you start putting them on railroads and steamships.
So I start the story in Damascus, in Ottoman Syria, or Palestine, as it was called at the time, in the 1840s. And so this isn't like they're sitting in St. Petersburg in the foreign ministry and they get a sense of this and they come up with some master plan. This comes very much from ground level experiences of Russian diplomatic officials who get posted to what are Ottoman lands at the time. So I mentioned that there is competition over Ottoman Syria, places that we know today as Lebanon, Syria, Israel, Palestine. These are areas that the imperial powers are all interested in. They're all kind of meddling in the area. The story that we have is they're all trying to get in through Christian populations. And there's truth to this, right? So Russia says we are an Orthodox power, and so it's our job to protect Orthodox Christians in Ottoman lands from persecution. And so they use this as a reason to go in. But this is where, you know, when I got into the archives, I found that and sort of stumbled upon this. Well, they too stumbled upon this. They went in thinking, well, we're going to use our shared Orthodox faith as a justification for expanding our diplomatic network in Ottoman lands, and then hopefully kind of infiltrating local populations and building, getting them to sort of see Russia, ally themselves with Russia, and get some sort of power through this and influence here.
Let me pause you a minute there, because this, you're talking of the 1840s, 1850s yeah. here, and the question becomes, well, why is this region really important? Now, for us today, many people would say, well, of course, oil, but this was not a major oil-producing region at that time. You know, industrialization was starting to really crank up, and so oil was important, but you know, why would anybody care about this area out there? It's not just the Russians, it's the British, it's the Germans, it's everybody.
Yeah, so you're right. This isn't about oil in this period, and this is a part of the world that we refer to today as the Middle East. The Ottoman Empire is seen as a declining empire. There's some truth to this. I already mentioned the Ottoman Empire is steadily losing territory. It's shrinking. I mentioned the Caucasus. Russia pushing into the Caucasus was in part encroaching on former Ottoman lands. The Crimea, which we talk about a lot today because Russia just invaded and annexed it, that was part of the Ottoman Empire until the late 18th century. So as Russia is expanding, this is happening largely at Ottoman expense. Greece becomes an independent state. That had been part of the empire, the Ottoman Empire, in the first half of the 19th century. So the European powers, why are they interested in, I mean, very briefly, they're interested in this part of the world because they're concerned about Ottoman decline, and mainly the Russians, the British, and the French, each is worried that if the Ottoman Empire collapses, that one of its rivals will move in and colonize it. And that is going to upset what they talk about, diplomats and politicians talk about, is the balance of power in Europe. So each is worried that one of the others is going to take over former Ottoman lands. It doesn't happen, as it turns out. This is a place where there's unrest, and there had been an attempt by someone who had been Muhammad Ali, who had been the governor of Egypt, to sort of create his own empire in Ottoman Syria. So there was a lot of political unrest. The Ottomans didn't have a very firm hold over this part of the empire. So that is, you know, so they're worried about this part of the empire falling out of Ottoman control, and no single one power wants another power to colonize it. We have to remember, this is a time when everyone's colonizing everything they can. You know, the Europeans, that is. So it's an imperial rivalry. And they're all kind of moving into the area and staking their claim. And so Russia goes in and this is the story, if you open, you know, crack open a history book on the imperial powers in the Middle East, this is what you'll get, is they all sort of, you know, the French went in and said, we're here to protect the Catholics, and the Russians went in and said, we're here in the name of Orthodoxy, and then the British, they had a little trouble because they said, well, we're here to protect the Jews and Protestants. They were also trying to convert people to Protestantism. So this has been told as a Christian story, and this was one of the interesting things for me in starting this research, is that there's this whole Muslim dimension to Russia's involvement in the area. something they hadn't anticipated. But once they went in, they said, well, we have all these Muslim subjects moving through the area, and many of them are coming to us, that is, consular officials, and asking for our help because they need so much support in making this really long journey to Mecca that at this time in history, many made it through Syria. Now, that's not true, of course, today. Today, when people make the Hajj, most of them are taking airplanes. So they're going from whatever city they're flying from straight to, I think most of them go to Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. So this traffic moving through, to get back to your original question, how do they start to think about this? It's very much just kind of on the ground. You have low-ranking diplomatic officials bumping up against this traffic. And then more and more of them are saying, they're sort of sharing information, and then they say, this seems to be a pretty big phenomenon, and then, of course, it keeps growing over. So it's a very gradual story, the story of how Russia starts to involve itself in this pilgrimage. And Russia is also looking to other powers. The British and the French and the Dutch are all doing the same thing because, you know, this might be a good point to remind us that most of the world's Muslims came under colonial rule over the 19th century. So the vast majority of Muslims are in the world are living under some form of colonial rule, and that also means that most Muslims, the vast majority, in fact, of Muslims who are making the Hajj in this period are colonial subjects.
Now, one of the things that tends to freak out a lot of governments, and this is true in past eras, but also true today, is that the mass migration of people is oftentimes very unpredictable and comes with a lot of scary things like infectious diseases and radical political ideas flowing backwards because, well, if you let these people go down there and somebody tells them, hey, it kind of sucks to be under Russian rule, why don't you have a revolution? That can kind of worry the folks in Moscow Central there. So is there any concern about preventing this movement of people? It's like, no, that's not due to Hajj. That's not a real good idea.
Yeah, that's actually, you know, my book is the first book on the Hajj, but there had been a couple of articles, and there was more work done on other colonial situations, so on the British and the Hajj and the French and the Hajj. And there's the sort of consensus of the narrative that you get putting all the scholarly work together is that the European powers, why did they get involved in the Hajj? Well, because they couldn't stop it and because they were afraid of it. So I would say, first off, we want to remind ourselves we're in the 21st century when borders and border control mean something very different from what it meant in the 19th century. So even if, sure, there were politicians, Russian politicians, who said this is terrible and let's ban it, and they did try to ban it several times, which just meant issuing a decree saying the Hajj is banned. Now, that didn't stop many people from going. You can, just because you issue a decree doesn't mean that it actually has an effect on what people are doing. And the borders were very porous. And, you know, again, if you look at a map, you look at Russia has a very long southern border, Ottoman lands, Persian lands, Afghanistan. So people just continued to go in spite of bans. And they realized this. They said, okay, we tried to ban it, but we couldn't. But also they have another problem, which is that this, as I mentioned, this is an obligation, one of the rules for Muslims. It's central to their faith, whether or not they go on it or not. So Russia officially had issued in the late 18th century a decree of official toleration for what they called tolerated faith. So not every single, Russia is very internally diverse in terms of religion, but it issued this decree in the late 18th century that officially said we tolerate Buddhism, Catholicism, Judaism, and Islam. So you can't ban something that's central to one of the faiths that you claim to officially tolerate. This was a problem that they had. So banning it is not really an issue. And sure, there were people who said this is a problem, and cholera was a real concern, as were other infectious diseases. So part of the reason they get involved in it is because they're concerned about people bringing back in many of these ideas should be familiar to us today, by the way. you know, I'm sorry if that's so obvious to point out, but, you know, these people are moving back and forth, and what are they bringing back in to Russia and, you know, for the other colonial powers, back into our colonial possessions? What kinds of ideas are happening? What's happening in Mecca? And part, what's fueling this in part two is that Mecca has historically been, and is still today, it's closed to non-Muslims. So this sort of fuels this sense that they're doing something secret and conspiratorial in Mecca, and we need to worry about this because surely they're doing political things, and they're conspiring against the, you know, the colonialism, and they want to overturn European empires. So yes, there's a lot of concern about this, and that is part of why Russia, like other imperial powers, gets involved in the Hajj. But what I argue in the book is that they also, and I would say more and more you see voices in the documents in the archives of people saying, you know, these people are coming back and they're not actually doing anything. They don't seem to be doing anything political, and most of them don't have cholera. And in fact, there are many reasons why it would be, we can't stop it, and there are many reasons why it would be, it's good for us, it's potentially useful for us to support this. And, you know, financial reasons or economic reasons, and also strategic.
Yeah, let's go ahead and talk about those strategic and financial reasons. And also, if you could just lay out some of the logistics of this stuff, what the Russians did to facilitate this. Obviously, railroads helped a lot, but, you know, you got to feed these people as you're going around. They start building restaurants, or did little towns start appearing? Did, you know, the Russians help subsidize anybody, give people a, you know, a Hajj pack to go on this trip, say, yeah, if you want to go, here's some food and all that kind of stuff to go along with. So what were some of the logistics?
Well, and just briefly, I would say before I answer that, today we know that there are growing Muslim communities in Europe because of immigration. European governments today are doing a lot to support the Hajj, with helping with logistics, and Russia too. Russia has, we often hear that France has the largest Muslim community in all of Europe, but that's not right. It's actually Russia. You would have to think of Europe not just as Western Europe, but as you know, all of Europe. Russia has a Muslim population today of about 10 to 15%, and the government has been doing things to support the Hajj. And many of these things are similar to, you know, to get to your question, to what they did in the late 19th century. So yes, subsidizing travel, giving discounted tickets during Hajj season for pilgrims, arranging special travel during Hajj season. So again, because it was seasonal, they sort of saw this as this makes it, and theoretically it did make it predictable. So we know that they're all going to start going, they're all going to go in this 2 month period in order to get to the Arabian Peninsula in time for the scheduled Hajj ritual. So the Ministry of Transport, in the archives, I remember seeing this huge map that they had put up on a wall, and there was all this colored pencil where they were arranging for, okay, this year we're going to need to assign this much rolling stock to go to these, you know, the railroad network was all these different lines. So we need to send this much rolling stock to these railroad lines so that they have enough, because we expect this many thousands of people to go, and we're going to kind of rearrange the connections among these lines so that pilgrims can get, go nonstop, say from Tashkent, which is in today's Uzbekistan, to Odessa, which is in Ukraine. So, you know, you could get from Tashkent to Odessa, they advertise this in the newspapers, you can get there in 8.5 days, which is really fast. So, yes, subsidies, arranging special travel, they had special passports that they created for Hajj pilgrims. They opened consulates abroad to support pilgrims. So Jeddah, for example, which is in today's Saudi Arabia, Russia had no other reason for being in Jeddah except for the Hajj. So creating institutions, subsidies, and trying to facilitate fast, relatively hassle-free, transport. Now, I do want to emphasize that they were, it wasn't simply that they provided these services and Muslims kind of flocked like sheep to these services. They also were always having conversations about, well, they seem to be changing their routes. So they were kind of chasing the traffic also, trying to mainstream the traffic onto a route that they wanted, but also they were aware that they had to kind of follow, you know, pilgrims wanted they could revert to their old land routes, which many did, if they were unhappy with conditions along the railroad steamship lines.
Now, you mentioned two reasons for doing this. One has an international aspect to it, to advance the secular state and imperialist agenda of Russia. And the other one is to basically channel lucrative profits into state coffers. So let's discuss how they actually did that, starting with the profit motive. And we'll get to the international aspect in a minute. So how did the Russians say, oh, this is a great chance to make lots of cash, let's do this? What was the reasoning there, and what were some of the ways they did that?
So I would say this was more of an aspiration than a great success, but basically they built these railroads and then found that they were having trouble getting, in many cases, getting passengers to ride the rails. And so they felt they were losing out on revenues. Another thing that came up that was really interesting is you had mass out-migration from the Russian Empire largely to North America and the United States in the late 19th, early 20th century. Something like 4 million people left the Russian. I mean, people are moving all around in this period, and there's mass immigration, as we know, into the United States in this period. Most of the people leaving the Russian Empire are Jewish and are Jews and Poles. And so this comes up at one point. I guess it was foreign steamship companies that transported these millions of people from Black Sea ports to North American ports. And so they say, you know, we missed out on all of this transport. This could have been revenues for the state, and we missed out on that, so let's not miss out on this. They sort of tie these two things together. So there's a way in which they see this traffic, which is not surprising. I mean, any kind of mass movement of people is going to involve problems, but it also is going to generate economic activity. So they say, well, we should really capitalize on this because we're having trouble filling our trains, and we need revenues they're not just trying to, you know, I mentioned modernization, which is this big kind of vague term, but they're trying to develop industry, they're trying to modernize the army, they need money to do this. So this is one way, and, you know, again, they're trying to make the best of, I mean, many of them would prefer not to have all these people moving through the empire at this set time of year, but they're saying, okay, this is a reality, so how can we not just manage it, but also how is this something that we could channel in a way that's useful to the state? And it was very useful for me to read other, you know, one of the nice things that about this story, one of the things I'm trying to do is say this isn't just about Muslims making the Hajj. When you start to sort of back up, you say, well, there are lots of people are moving around the empire in unprecedented numbers, and as you say, in unpredictable ways. So, you know, they're trying to control the movement of peasants. You know, serfs were emancipated in the Russian Empire in 1861, and you know, not everyone is moving. I want to, you know, make that point. It costs money. So we want to avoid the impression that, like, everyone is moving. But there is mass movement happening in unpredictable new ways, and there's an attempt by the Russian state to say, okay, well, if we could, this is going to happen if we could, but let's try to figure out ways to channel this in ways, so get them to move ways that we want them to, but also to capitalize on their movement to, you know, capture revenues for the state, in part by getting them to ride these new railroads that need passengers.
Yeah. And how about the international aspect of this? Obviously, everybody's trying to lay a claim to the falling Ottoman Empire, the weakening Ottoman Empire. So you got the Europeans making their way, the Russians are. How would controlling Hajj routes have any impact on their ability to further their imperialist goals? I mean, it's just, you just wave goodbye to them and they go down there and they come back. And it's like, well, how does that further our goals internationally?
So they, I would say they don't ultimately, just to be really clear about what I say in the book, they don't ultimately control the routes. They set up what I call an infrastructure along the main routes. And, you know, certainly in the late 19th, early 20th century, most Muslims from Russia are, you know, it's pretty much impossible to make the Hajj without having dealings with some kind of colonial official. And most of them are taking the Black Sea route because it's more convenient, and many consider it safer than the alternatives. But controlling, you know, you see this in the correspondence among officials where they say, well, we have an opportunity here to go into, I mentioned Jeddah before in Saudi Arabia. They say, well, we are interested in moving in. This, again, is part of the Ottoman Empire, and the British are involved, the Dutch are getting involved, the French, because there's this sense that the Ottoman Empire is on the verge of collapse. And when this happens, you want to be sure that you have some kind of presence there so you can stake a claim. So what we consider today Saudi Arabia, this is another arena of imperial competition. So they say, okay, this, yes, the Hajj, we worry about disease and we worry about what they're doing in when they go to this secret place that is closed to non-Muslims, Mecca. But also, because of this movement, this gives us a reason to expand our diplomatic apparatus in this part of the world where we have an interest in staking a claim, because we're competing. I mean, by tracing this history, one of the things I hope people get from the book is a sense that Russia is in all these parts of the world where we never think of Russia having connections. Like today, Russia sent troops into Syria, and the question seemed to arise, like, what does Russia have to do with Syria? What does Russia have to do with the Middle East? And through this subject, you can see that they're interested in these parts of the world, and they're kind of tapping into the Hajj as an opportunity to establish institutions in parts of the Middle East and essentially lay claim to these areas as places that are connected to the Russian Empire through the religious networks of Russian subjects.
Yeah. So, yeah, just staking a claim there, because everybody else is staking a claim there, is a pretty good idea for, yeah, it's an important region of the world. Yeah. How about the reaction of the Muslims to this? You mentioned that not all of them agreed to go according to the scheduled routes. They oftentimes went in other directions. But was there a lot of resistance or resentment for the Russians trying to control this? Or did a lot of people say, hey, thanks for building these railroad routes? It makes it a lot more convenient.
So there was a mix of reactions. You had Muslims who, and I should say the book is mainly about, you know, just very simply, what Russia inherits this tradition because of imperial expansion, and how does it react to it, and what does it do with it. So Muslim perspectives are included in the book, but the main focus of the book is on how Russia tries to grapple with this tradition and how it responds to it. But so Muslims have, there are many different responses from Muslims in Russia and Muslims who experience Russian involvement in the Hajj. So there are some who, again, these tend to be people who are elites with privileged status under kind of colonial elites with a privileged status under the Russian administration. They say this is wonderful. This is good for Muslims. You know, this shows the benevolence of the Russian state towards its Muslim population. So that's one perspective. There are others who say, this is not really, who are very troubled by this. One person who comes to mind is Abdul Rashid Ibrahim, who's a well-known Tatar intellectual who makes the Hajj as part of broader travels in 1908. And he's very disturbed by, I went on the Hajj. There's this expectation I'm going to go to Mecca, and this is going to be a purely Muslim place. And he has to go through what's called a disinfection facility because all the imperial powers are worried about cholera. And the door to the building is opened by, he's greeted by what he called a Christian woman. And he's very upset about this. Like, why are Europeans and Russians involving themselves in this Muslim ritual, this thing that's central to our faith and has nothing to do with them? So he's very disturbed by this. He also is standing on the quay in Odessa, this port city in the Black Sea that I mentioned most of the traffic is going through there, and he watches as a ship comes in and you have Orthodox Christian pilgrims get off. It's come back from the Middle East, and you have Hajj pilgrims come off, and he's disgusted because he said, you see all these sloppy Christian pilgrims, and they're just allowed to stroll through the city, whereas the authorities take all the Hajj pilgrims and they kind of hurry them away to a disinfection facility. So he is very disturbed by how Hajj pilgrims, Muslim pilgrims, are treated differently from Christian pilgrims, even though they're coming from the same part of the world. They're seen as diseased or potential disease carriers, and they're under suspicion. This is very distasteful to him and upsetting. There are others who show up at consulates, right? So there are, if you're making this. This is one thing that we haven't touched on yet, but it's thousands of miles to get from the Russian Empire. You know, again, if you look at a map, you can see how far it is to get from, say, the Volga-Ural region, if someone came from Kazan, east of Moscow, to get to Saudi Arabia, it's thousands of miles to get there. So people have lots of needs. Lots of people get robbed along the way. And so people show up at consulates and they write letters and say, you know, we're so grateful that our wonderful Russian Empire that we're a part of has these services for us. Please help us. We need money. So, you know, the responses are mixed. And of course, when you see something like a document that in the consular archives where you have a Russian subject who is Muslim coming to the Russian consular authorities, you have to think about, well, why would he be using this flattering, effusive language? Does this really mean that he loves being a Russian subject, or is he being pragmatic here because there are needs that he has, along the way to, and the needs were, you know, huge, just people ran out of money, people, you know, as I mentioned, would get robbed, would get attacked and needed medical help. So, the consular officials in many cases were overwhelmed. But, you know, the many different perspectives. It would be wrong to say that they simply resented it. It would also be wrong to say that they thought it was a wonderful thing that simply a wonderful thing that the Russian state did for them.
Yeah, that aspect of your book, the chapter that you focus on that, is really nice and nuanced and kind of shows, you know, people react to one another in a lot of different ways and use the resources and view the resources in a lot of different ways. What I want to turn next to relates to what you were just talking about, the Ibrahim, who was looking at this in 1908. And that's a really important period of time in Russian history. You just had the 1905 revolution, which starts to shake up the Tsarist regime. Not entirely, but really starts to change things. And then in 1917, the Bolshevik really hits the fan. And how does this new environment, revolutionary Russia from 1905 through 1917, and then into the Soviet era, how does this change the way that the Hajj is viewed and managed?
So one of the interesting, and this again I cover in, this is the last two chapters, chapters 4 and 5. This was really interesting to me. So post-1905, there's a revolution in Russia in 1905, and the Tsar, under duress, begrudgingly grants a constitution, so Russia finally becomes a constitutional monarchy, and he also allows for what's called the Duma, which is a like a parliament or a congress. So officially, it's going to be a constitutional monarchy, and he issues what's called the October Manifesto. One of the things he says in this is, again, like, this is taking stock of the fact that Russia is a multi-ethnic, multi-confessional empire, very large Jewish populations, very large Muslim populations. Muslims were second to, they were the second largest group in the empire, second only to Orthodox Christians. And I should say that Russia at this point has more Muslims than the Ottoman Empire. So the Ottoman Empire has been shrinking. It has about 14 million Muslims. Russia has 20 million Muslims at its peak, just before World War I. So post-1905, so it issues this manifesto, and one of the things that is promised is full religious toleration. So there's this decree in the late 18th century that promises religious toleration, but this is supposed to mean more in terms of equality. So not just the Orthodox Church is privileged and others are secondary to it, but there's at least a promise of this that hasn't been fully thought out, and not all Russian officials by any means are on board with this. But this is promised. So post 1905, well, for one thing, the Hajj is bigger because it keeps growing and growing and growing, as more and more people are making it, telling people how to make it. The railroad network is expanded. The Trans-Siberian is finished in 1903. So just before the 1905 revolution, you finally have the completion of the Trans-Siberian Railroad, so more and more people are going. And also, and this is what I saw in Odessa, there's a way in which some Muslims have internalized this rhetoric about fuller religious freedom or a sense of religious equality by saying, well, why then are we still having problems with the Hajj? Isn't this, if the government is claiming now a different atmosphere and a different approach to the different religious groups in the empire, why are we still having problems? Why are Muslims being treated, you know, forced to go into disinfection facilities when Orthodox Christian pilgrims aren't? And they start writing about this in the newspapers. This is another thing. You have more, the press grows after 1905. So you have these very public, so if before 1905 it was more the state was trying to figure these things out and there was some discussion in the newspapers, it kind of explodes after 1905. You have Muslims writing in saying, well, the state claims to be, you know, offering more religious freedom and more government support for all of the religious faiths, including Islam, but why is it still not organizing fully the Hajj? Now, I would say, like, organizing the Hajj, no one has ever really, I mentioned the Saudis today still struggle because, not because it's the Hajj, but just because it's a mass phenomenon involving 3 million people. So, I mean, the tasks are enormous. So there is the discussion, the terms of the discussion change after 1905, and it as I said, some Muslims, those that I saw writing into Muslim newspapers, seem to have internalized this rhetoric, and also not just Muslims, there are liberals in, there's a, what's called the cadets, the constitutional Democrats, also start writing in their newspapers, like, this is what kind of a state that promises to protect and support all of its subjects, regardless of religion, would allow the Hajj to go on in such a disorganized fashion. So this also tells us that, you know, the Hajj is sort of this very specific thing that I'm looking at. And in some ways, it's, you know, it happens once a year. But it's become this big, it's very public, it's very visible. And even though it just happens once a year, it's something that many people are thinking about and talking about as related to Russia, its future, its politics, and how this big empire is managing its internally diverse populations. And not just Muslims, of course, we're talking about this.
So what happens then in 1917? Because between 1905 and 1917, the Tsarist regime is capitulating to some liberal demands, but also trying to retain its power. And so it's a juggling act. It's got a lot of thing on it, on their minds. And then World War I, that wasn't very helpful. And then all of a sudden the Soviet Revolution. What changes there?
So there are two revolutions in 1917. There's the February Revolution and then the October Revolution, which is the Bolshevik Revolution. But as you mentioned, World War I starts earlier. And for Muslims making the Hajj, what this does is, you know, during the war, it just becomes harder to make the pilgrimage. Some of them are making it, but the communication networks clearly aren't working the way they used to. And often they can't get transport or it's not safe. So the numbers kind of drop during World War I. The state is focused on other things. And, you know, my assumption going into this was that, and then the Soviets come to power, and as we know, the Soviets were Marxists. The Bolsheviks who were responsible for the 1917 revolution and then created the Soviet state and the Soviet leadership, they were committed to eradicating religion from public life. You weren't supposed to be religious. And so my assumption starting out with this project was that the story would end with World War I. And I was fascinated to find this stuff in the Odessa archives about how Odessa reemerges in the 1920s as what I call a hub of Hajj traffic. So what happens is that you have it seems to start with petitions from Muslims outside of what is becoming the Soviet Union. They start writing to the Soviet government and saying, we used to take these routes through the Russian Empire. They kind of fell out of use during World War I because it wasn't possible because the war was going on. And now the war is over, and we want to go. We don't want to go by land to Mecca. We want to take these old land routes again. Can you please open them up to us? And so very briefly in the late 1920s, and this is also, there are debates about this among Soviet officials, but they do kind of revive the old Tsarist. They reopen the routes through what are now Soviet lands to take railroads and then steamships from what are now Soviet ports, and they they start actually trying to encourage Muslims to come in from, and this is different from the Tsarist period, in that they say, well, this isn't for Soviet citizens. This, we don't want our, you know, Muslims within the Soviet Union. And you know, as I mentioned, there were, you know, six of what would become the 15 Soviet republics had Muslim majorities. This wasn't talked about much at the time, but what became the Soviet Union was, had the fifth largest Muslim population in the world of all countries. So they say, well, we don't want our own Muslims to go because we're trying to make them good Soviet citizens, but this will just be for foreigners. It's a way to generate, hard currency, that is foreign revenue, to fuel industrialization. But also they have this idea, and this is really fascinating to me, because then you think about when people migrate, what are they seeing, like where are they, what lands are they going through and what are they seeing? They said this is useful to us because if we can get Muslims from Persia and Afghanistan and China to come through the Soviet Union on, in making the Hajj, they can see what we're building and maybe they'll return home with a very positive impression of the Soviet Union. So while they're coming through Central Asia, for example, why not take them on a tour of a, you know, an emerging collective farm, or take them to see a factory? These are some of the discussions they had. You know, let's use this opportunity as they're moving through Soviet lands to expose them to this wonderful society that we're building. So, and what cuts this short then is in 1929 with the global depression, the Hajj kind of drops out, the numbers drop out drastically, people stop going, and my impression was the trail kind of ran out in the archives. I think by, you know, the early 30s, this was not something that they continued. So it seems to have ended, the Soviet experiment in sponsoring the Hajj seems to have ended by 1930.
Yeah, and that's a nice way to end the book, too. Otherwise, you'd have to do a lot more archival research, and it'd be a lot bigger book. So, but it's a nice story that you tell here between the middle part of the 1900s and 1930. And again, it's a great book. It's one of these books that really opens up your eyes to something that you had never known, as you mentioned several times, that Russia has today and has had for a long time a very substantial Muslim population. And this always plays out in politics and the way people are thinking about things. So a great book, and we'll refer people back to that, The Russian Hajj. And to finish off here, I just have a couple questions for you. First of all, in going through this research, was there anything that really surprised you? Did you ever change your mind about some of the a priori expectations that you had about history in the region?
I mean, I guess for me, the biggest thing was that by, as I started to kind of, you know, gather documents and to see, it was sort of like picking up the thread and seeing and finding more and more and more in the archives, and then sort of piecing together, I guess, the geographic dimensions of it, starting to understand where, what the roots were, and, you know, how people got from Russia to the Arabian Peninsula. For me, and I guess this is one of the things I hope that people read the book and you know, have impressions of Russia and Russia in the world will take away, is that by trace, like through the Hajj, we, you know, you can see Russia in the world in a completely different way. That is, Russia in places that we don't usually think of Russia as having any connections to. So, you know, and typically for, you know, for certainly for the 20th, most of the, all of the 20th century, Russian historians have typically thought of Russia, the Russian Empire, in relation to Europe, for good reasons. You know, Russia was, in a, you know, under Peter the Great, let's, you know, trying to be a European empire, trying to be like Europe, but different. And so there are things that you miss when you only, so it's important to compare Russia to Europe. This makes sense, and this must be done. And also, you know, through this one major Islamic network, the Hajj, what is revealed is not just people making this pilgrimage and the problems that Russia had with it, but you also, I hope, can see Russia in the world in a different light and connected to places where it was very much connected, parts of the Middle East and as well as other parts of Asia. But you know, it, you just, I hope this will open up, you know, new opportunities, new, you know, I hope others will sort of take this and explore other ways that Russia and the Middle East were connected. But it just makes Russia look very different. You sort of, see Russia as part of the world, a part of other parts of the world that you don't usually associate with Russia.
And one final question, too, and you do this in your book. It's really nice. You have a few pages at the very end, concluding remarks, thinking about what this means to our contemporary world. You know, that was then, this is now. So what does then have to tell us about now?
Well, I guess the main thing I would say is that the story that I'm telling is not one in which Russia, you know, Russian officials are simply saying, this is a huge problem that we have to deal with, and how are we going to manage this? Because I think, there's a way in which we think about, there's a narrative, I would say, building today about Islam as a problem for Europe, Islam, as somehow not part of European history. So the book, I think, makes it very clear that Muslims are part of the history of Russia. They're not some alien group. They're not, and also, Russia's response to the Hajj was not, simply, and this was a part of it, oh, this is a headache in many ways, this is, you know, we worry about disease, but, you know, ultimately, the discussions were about how do we have this inheritance, and how do we, there was sort of optimism, that I want to emphasize the optimism among many officials that, you know, there are benefits to be gotten from this, and there's an optimism that this could be sort of integrated and sort of remade into a Russian tradition. So there's a way in which the history of Muslims and of Islam in Russia and more broadly Europe today is thought of as conflict driven, and as you know, Muslims are just cannot really be made to be part of, or they're just sort of alien to European history, and this I would say is not right.
Well, that is an important lesson to think about as we move forward, and I really appreciate your work. I want to thank you for writing Russian Hajj. My guest today has been Eileen Kane. Eileen, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.